Recording.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, comrades, welcome to this educational of the Consistent Democrats. We're going to have a discussion on the last part of chapter 9 of The Revolution Betrayed, which is on social relations in the Soviet Union. We did actually study the first bit of this chapter about 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago, I think it was. And that was quite an interesting discussion, and we'll see how this one goes. Yeah. Okay. So there are three sections we're exploring here, which basically form one unit. State capitalism, is the bureaucracy a ruling class, and the character of the Soviet Union not yet decided by history. Those sections together are a theoretical snapshot of the USSR at a particular point in time, and that point in time is their starting point. So Trotsky is dismissal of those who attempt to characterise the USSR as state capitalist, in my view, is appropriately brief. And he points out that in dismissing it that no one knows what it means. It's a catch-all that describes what happens when a bourgeois state takes control of or intervenes in the economy. And he describes something that was later given credence in the works of Tony Clift, who is the founder of the SWP at the end of World War II. But he demonstrates its unviability when he says, quote, that theoretically, to be sure, it is possible to conceive a situation in which the bourgeoisie as a whole constitutes itself as a stock company which, by means of its state, administers the whole national economy. The economic laws of such a regime would present no mysteries. A single capitalist, as is well known, receives in the form of profit not that part of the surplus value which is directly created by workers of his own enterprise, but a share of the combined surplus value created throughout the country proportionate to the amount of his own capital. Under an integral state capitalism, this law of the equal rate of profit would be realised not by devious routes, that is, competition among different capitals, but immediately and directly through state bookkeeping. But such a regime never existed. And because of profound contradictions amongst the proprietors themselves, never will exist. The more so since in its quality of universal repository of capitalist property, the state will be too tempting an object for social revolution. Now that's basically Clift's thesis on what the nature of the USSR and China and all the degenerated and deformed workers' states actually were. And it's what's given Trotskyism a bad name over much of the world, even though Trotsky, in effect, ridiculed Clift's book before it was written. Clift himself says that such a regime could not come into existence organically under capitalism, but could only exist as a product of a proletarian revolution that failed. And while Trotsky pointed out that such a regime would be the ultimate self-destructive entity, Clift describes the USSR as pretty much the worst form of tyranny that ever existed. But it's a caricature of the Soviet Union in any case. There was no single accounting unit for profit, and everybody knows that wide sections of the Soviet economy were subsidised and run effectively at a loss. So much for a profit-driven economy. The expansion of the productive forces that drove the Soviet economy forward while the capitalist world was in the Great Depression was able to happen precisely because the driving force was social need, not profitability. Even though social need was distorted by what the bureaucracy considered was social need. He then goes through the various forms of state intervention in the economy under a variety of bourgeois reformist regimes, and even under fascism, and shows how they did not touch the basic relations of private property. When you talk about etatism, that's what they call it, etatism in the French social democratic sense, or even under the fascism of Mussolini, you're talking about the use of bourgeois state power to safeguard the rule of private property, not to abolish it. And that, to do that required a completely different movement and political program. So the question, is the bureaucracy a ruling class, is perhaps the most challenging part of this book so far, theoretically, because Trotsky notes that various bureaucratic bureaucracies, up to and including the fascist, rule on behalf of the bourgeoisie as a privileged class, that a privileged class that is, that's accustomed to being the masters. Whereas what you have in the bureaucracy of the workers of the Soviet Union is a formation that rules on behalf of a ruling class that does not have the habit of ruling and is a long oppressed class. So he writes this. He writes, the Soviet bureaucracy has risen above a class which is hardly emerging from destitution and darkness and has no tradition of dominion or command. Whereas the fascists, when they find themselves in power, are united with the big bourgeoisie by bonds of common interest, friendship, marriage, etc., the Soviet bureaucracy takes on bourgeois customs without having beside it a national bourgeoisie. In that sense, we cannot deny that it's something more than a bureaucracy. It is, in the full sense of the word, the sole privileged and commanding stratum in Soviet society. And then furthermore, he goes on, he says, the bureaucracy has expropriated the proletariat politically in order, by methods of its own, to defend the social conquests. But the very fact of its appropriation of political power in a country where the principal means of production are in the hands of the state creates a new and hitherto unknown relation between the bureaucracy and the riches of the nation. The means of production belong to the state, but the state, so to speak, belongs to the bureaucracy. And he projects, and it's not entirely obvious what he means, but I'll come on to that in a bit. He says this, he says, if these as yet wholly new relations should solidify, become the norm and be legalised, whether with or without resistance from the workers, they would, in the long run, lead to a complete liquidation of the social conquests of the proletarian revolution. But he also notes that this has not happened. He says, the bureaucracy has not yet created social supports for its dominion in the form of special types of property. It's compelled to defend state property as the source of its power and its income. In this aspect of its activity, it still remains a weapon of proletarian dictatorship. And then he goes into what that means for the bureaucracy. He notes this. He says, the bureaucracy has neither stocks nor bonds. It is recruited, supplemented, and renewed in the manner of administrative hierarchy, independently of any special property relations of its own. The individual bureaucrat cannot transmit to his heirs his rights in the exploitation of the state apparatus. The bureaucracy enjoys its privileges under the form of an abuse of power. It conceals its income. It pretends that as a special social group it doesn't even exist. Its appropriation of a vast share of the national income has the character of social parasitism. All this makes the position of the commanding Soviet stratum in the highest degree contradictory, equivocal and undignified, notwithstanding the completeness of its power and the smokescreen of flattery that conceals it. And thus, he says, the attempt to present the Soviet bureaucracy as a class of state capitalists will obviously not withstand criticism. And he drew some conclusions about the future course of the Soviet Union, which in my view were historically specific. We're not studying this as a holy text or anything like it. Everything's up for critical evaluation. But be that as it may, Trotsky writes about the automatism of capitalism and its ability to continue to prosper under a variety of political regimes. So he says, bourgeois society has in the course of its history displaced many political regimes and bureaucratic castes without changing its social foundations. It's preserved itself against the restoration of feudal and guild relations by the superiority of its productive methods. The state power has been able either to cooperate with capitalist developments or put brakes on it. but in general, the productive forces, upon a basis of private property and competition, have been working out their own destiny. And he contrasts that with the fate of the planned beginnings of the Soviet economy if the regime were to fall. And so he says, in contrast to this, the property relations which issued from the socialist revolution are indivisibly bound up with the new state as their repository. The predominance of socialists over petty bourgeois tendencies is guaranteed, not by the automatism of the economy, we're still far from that, but by political measures taken by the dictatorship. The character of the economy as a whole thus depends upon the character of the state power. And then there's the key package, a key passage that he draws out some conclusions about this. He says, a collapse of the Soviet regime would lead inevitably to the collapse of the planned economy and thus to the abolition of state property. The bond of compulsion between the trusts and the factories within them would fall away. The more successful enterprises would succeed in coming out on the road of independence. They might convert or they might find themselves, they might find themselves into stock companies, other transitional forms of property, one, for example, in which the workers should participate in the profits. The collective files would disintegrate at the same time and far more easily. The fall of the present bureaucratic dictatorship, if it were not replaced by a new socialist power, would mean a return to capitalist relations with a catastrophic decline of industry and culture. And that last bit is the key phrase. He says that the fall of the Stalinist regime to restoration would mean a catastrophic decline of industry and culture. And Trotsky expressed deep scepticism, for good reason, about the capacity and even intention of the Stalin regime to preserve the social conquests of the revolution. He wrote, during the last 15 years, the bureaucracy has changed its social condition even more deeply than its ideas. Since all of the strata of Soviet society, the bureaucracy has best solved its own social problem and is fully content with the existing situation. It has ceased to offer any subjective guarantee whatsoever of the socialist direction of its policy. It continues to preserve state property only to the extent that it fears the proletariat. And aspects of this came true long after Trotsky's death. The subjective character of the socialist commitment of the bureaucracy atrophied completely in the Soviet Union, and very leading figures in the Communist Party, centred around Gorbachev and Yeltsin, basically junked that socialist commitment even in words. And that took place both in the USSR, now mainly in Russia, and in the giant deformed worker state of China, which did not even exist when Trotsky wrote this book, but which emulated much of what was analysed by Trotsky in The Revolution Betrayed. And about the USSR, Trotsky wrote that, quote, the October Revolution has been betrayed by the ruling stratum, but not yet overthrown. It has a great power of resistance, coinciding with the established property relations, with the living force of the proletariat, the consciousness of its best elements, the impasse of world capitalism, and the inevitability of world revolution. But that confidence of the proletariat in the socialist mission of the USSR had been considerably damaged by, say, 1989 to 92, when miners in the Soviet Union, for instance, went on strike to support Yeltsin's pro-capitalist demands, even though that led to their jobs being massacred, actually, you know. What is important, though, in both Russia and China, is what has not happened, despite the horrors of Yeltsin's shock treatment in the 1980s. It's not resulted in a return to capitalist relations with a catastrophic decline of industry and culture. That's something we've tried to explain and assess the reasons for. It's obvious that the imperialists do not trust the sustainability of the changes in the direction of capitalism, that have taken place in Russia and China. It's obvious that some sort of capitalist restorationist process has happened in Russia and China. I mean, Russia is no longer dominated by a communist party, and the communist party in China is dominated by a capitalist class of billionaires. The general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party is actually a dollar billionaire. But there's still something different about Russia and China. Economic planning was never abolished in China per se, and the state machine, in which the billionaires call the shots, has large elements of planning about it. In Russia, there was a terrible neoliberal shock and decline, but then a revival under Putin in which things were not fully rolled back to the situation of the Soviet Union, but there was a considerable restatification of the economy. Yeah. And then we've seen the outbreak of a new Cold War in the last decade and a half, in which the same demonology about Russia and China has taken pretty much centre stage, as Russia and China are once again seen as the main enemy by Western imperialism. And clearly, in my view anyway, this still has a class element to it. They hate these countries because the capitalism that's been restored with a weak, it's weak. It's not weak vis-a-vis the imperialists, but it's weak vis-a-vis the massive pro-capitalist deformations that mark their economies and their state apparatus, which they've actually proved unable to abolish. And it's produced the strange phenomenon of the bourgeoisie blowing hot and cold in dealing with them, epitomised by the duality between Biden and Trump. But it does appear that Trotsky's contention, and I'll quote it again, that a collapse of the Soviet regime would lead inevitably to the collapse of the planned economy and thus to the abolition of state property, has not really been borne out. And his contention did not work out either, that the predominance of socialist over petty bourgeois tendencies is guaranteed, not by the automatism of the economy, we're still far from that, but by political measures taken by the dictatorship. It does seem that there is a degree of automatism of the economy that falsified some of his most catastrophic predictions of what a counter-revolution would bring. It seems that the fact that it took a further of half a century of the Soviet Union surviving, and China among others, which owe a lot of their vitality to the Soviet Union anyway, that meant that the planned element was not as fragile as Trotsky thought. And that might modify some of the scenarios in part three, the part where Trotsky heads it that the character of the Soviet Union is not defined by history, where he says that he defines what might happen if a revolutionary party took back power in the Soviet Union in that period, or conversely, what would happen if the Stalinist regime collapsed. And of course, Trotsky never lived to see these things happen. That doesn't make his work any less groundbreaking or useful, but it must be studied critically, not as a sterile dogma. Marx and Engels made many errors of perspective, but that doesn't invalidate their critique of capitalism. Not at all. You know, they thought that revolution might happen in the 19th century. They were wrong, you know, but they weren't wrong overall. And that doesn't invalidate their critiques. And nor does Trotsky's perspective turning out to be wrong invalidate this, you know. But it does mean it has to be evaluated critically. I mean, there's still a need for the revolutionary working class to reconquer power in Russia and China. And also smaller examples of this, like Vietnam and, you know, indeed all the ex-Soviet states up to and including Ukraine. The proletariat needs to reconquer power. You know, I mean, there's still a need for the class-conscious working class to gain full political power, which is never actually held in other surviving deformed worker states that still exist, like Cuba and North Korea. And there is more ideological confusion created the way things have worked out, as China is ruled by billionaire communists, in quotes, and Russia which is seen by the bourgeoisie as crypto-communist, as a crypto-communist enemy state, is actually led by a centre-right Orthodox Christian, a fairly charismatic figure, that's Putin. You know, and that's created an anomalous situation that needs to be resolved, with a polarisation of these forces against imperialism. And yet these forces cannot abolish imperialism, and they've got no intention of doing so. I mean, I think the multipolar world is an ideological expression of a modified form of Stalinism's programme of peaceful coexistence of the old workers' states with imperialism. It's just as much an illusion, it's just as much a reformist utopia, a bourgeois reformist utopia, as that. You know, and we need a new revolutionary communist international, as these forces cannot remotely begin to deal with the many problems that capitalism has bequeathed humanity, not least the damage to the biosphere. But on the other hand, I think Trotsky's definition of the Soviet Union, written in 1936, even today, it still looks not bad. You know, what I'll quote it, it simply says, the Soviet Union is a contradictory society halfway between capitalism and socialism, in which A, the productive forces are still far from adequate to give the state property a socialist character, B, the tendency toward primitive accumulation created by want breaks out through innumerable pores of the planned economy, and C, norms of distribution preserving a bourgeois character lie at the basis of a new differentiation of society. D, the economic growth, while slowly bettering the situation of the toilers, promotes a swift formation of privileged strata. E, exploiting the social antagonisms, the bureaucracy has converted itself into an uncontrolled caste alien to socialism. And F, the social revolution, betrayed by the ruling party, still exists in property relations and in the consciousness of the toiling masses. And G, a further development of the accumulated contradictions can as well lead to socialism as back to capitalism. And H, on the road to capitalism, the counter-revolution would have to break the resistance of the workers. And I, on the road to socialism, the workers would have to overthrow the bureaucracy. In the last analysis, the question will be decided by a struggle of living social forces both on the national and the world arena. Now, I don't think that's a very long definition. But I don't think it can be faulted as a definition, though today I would argue that primitive accumulation in Russia and China is something of the past, you know. As a long time past. By the time of the counter-revolutions of 1989-92, which may actually explain a lot of what we're dealing with today, the fact that that has passed and we're in a different phase now. But I'll conclude there and open it up to discussion for comrades. Cheers, thank you. Who wants to speak? Weebo.
Yes, well, thanks for the presentation. You just, in the definition of what was the Soviet Union, it's contradictory society. There's one element which has been kind of controversial, if I recall correctly, going back to 89-92, is on the road to capitalism, the counter-revolution would have to break the resistance of the workers. Well, I mean, when did that occur, or actually, why did that not occur? I mean, there were some massive, apparently, strikes during the counter-revolution in the Soviet Union by mine workers, I believe it was, but that was very limited and of a short duration. As well, I have to get used to looking at China. I need to do some more readings on the subject, of course. China no longer being a deformed worker state, but some kind of proto-capitalist one, which has a partially planned economy. So at what point in time did China transform from a worker state, deformed, to a now somewhat, I'm not sure what term to use exactly. Some proto-capitalist regime is my question. And also, if both China and Russia are some type of capitalism, are they now not indicating via the expansion of BRICS, and all these BRICS countries are, of course, based on mostly on the gigantic Chinese planned economy, is that not some kind of incipient expression of them becoming imperialistic, taking that they're spreading across the globe and making favorable trade deals for natural resources, etc., kind of dictated from above by the Putin and Chinese leadership.
Who else wants to speak? Marie?
Can I say something then? Thank you for the presentation. Ian, this is a superb document which needs taking in small sections in order to absorb each one. And I would have thought that it would be a good idea to go back in the future, go back to it or to parts of it, because it's so rich. One cannot give it all it deserves in such a quick way. I would like to just go back to this question of statism, etatism, which is it was interesting what you said about the SWP and state capitalism. As far as I understand, of course, this is not possible, so that the whole state would be capitalist and become a stock company. This is contrary to the nature of the system, and the system cannot do this, because it needs competition in order to realize profit making. So this is the way I see it. The state capitalism, of course, is as far as the capitalist system in crisis goes, to actually try to put some order in the disorder, in the anarchy of the various capitalist interests. Because if everyone is producing one thing in order to acquire the market, then you have everyone fighting everybody else. So it needs a power which actually explains that one has to produce certain things in certain cases, and so that requires some regulation. So I think this was well expressed in the document, where he says the rise of etatism or statism comes from the crisis of the system. It is state intervention on the basis of private property with the goal of saving private property. It leads to the transfer of the damages and the decay of the capitalist system from the shoulders of the powerful onto those who are less powerful. And about this, I think one should go back to the question of the bailout, which took place in the world in 2008. I mean, the bailout was an example of this all over the world, an experience which the world masses have seen, that billions, I think it was 500 billion in the European Union, which were actually handed over to the banks in order to keep them going, so that they would not be going bankrupt, because the bankruptcy of the banks would have created an immense social crisis and probably surely revolutionary currents forming, revolutionary ideas. And so the system, the capitalist system, in its panic, invented a system of quantitative easing and the rest of it. And so a mass of resources was handed over to a sector of capitalism in a way which was was removed from the masses, which is still being taken from us at the moment. When they say that there is inflation and it's Russia who is creating inflation, this is not so. What's that now? I think Weibo needs to.
All right, I've got it. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, right. So, yeah, what I meant to say was in order to save private property, it wasn't to save anything, it wasn't to save the nation, it was to save private property that the banks were bailed out. And that was an example of étatism, if anything could actually be an example, a better example than that. And it was on the world scale, which I think is an important aspect. I mean, at the time of Trotsky, all these things used to happen in countries or in markets. But now the market is worldwide, and these things are becoming more significant, what Trotsky explains, becoming significant in the sense that we are looking at what private property is doing in order to protect itself on a world scale. So now they transfer not resources from one side of the population onto the other, but from countries to the other, bankrupting entire countries like Afghanistan or Syria or Libya. I think in order to protect private property on a world scale, I think this might be an aspect to look at in the future again. I would like later on, yeah, I will come back because I've got two other points to make, but perhaps leaving other people to make their own. Yeah,
yeah, sure. Who else wants to speak? Anybody?
I'll say something.
Yeah, sure, John.
No, I mean, just all this, you know, about what is the ruling class, what isn't, and all this is, I mean, I don't know if I'm using the term impressionistic right, but that's all I can personally give, you know, an impressionistic thing of the thing, because I haven't, you know, like most Marxists, I haven't studied Marx to the extent where I understand these things, and I haven't studied the debates about ruling classes and, you know, what Marx actually says and what the following debates were. So I can only give an impressionistic view of, you know, of whether the bureaucracy was a class or not. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to spend years studying the stuff, you know, and that's that we all haven't got time for. So all we're giving is an impression. All I'm giving, and you know, and a lot of Marxists are giving, is an impressionistic view of what sounds most right to us about the development of the Soviet Union and that. But as to all the debates within it and what Marx actually said about what constitutes a class and how classes and bureaucracies develop is a debate I haven't really gone into.
Oh, Paul's right. Oh, great. Oh. Hello, Paul. Yeah. Who else wants to speak? Well, shall I come back just for a little minute? I just want to respond to a couple of things, particularly Weibo on the question of workers' resistance in the counter-revolution in 1989 to 1992. I mean, the only country I know of where there was significant working-class resistance to capitalist restoration was probably Romania, where there was actually a situation where Romanian miners actually beat the hell out of some right-wing capitalist restorationist types in one or two confrontations sometime in 1990. I remember that happening. But I also remember in Russian miners going on strike in the Kuzbass and possibly even the Donbass, going on strike in support of Yeltsin, you know. and Yeltsin was promising to accelerate capitalist restoration. This is before 1991. Yeah, I think there was obvious. This is the point I was making. There was obviously a change in consciousness of the working class. Because Trotsky wrote that the tradition of the bureaucracy still existed in the consciousness of the proletariat, but he was writing in 1936, and I don't think that was true by the time it got to the end of the sort of Stalinist regime towards the Gorbachev period and the The working class in those days was 50 odd years later, you know, and therefore a new generation of the working class had grown up in a formally socialist state, but bureaucratically deformed. And they hadn't really had an experience of the revolution, and they lived in this peculiar situation. And that is, you know, I think that built up illusions in capitalism, in the working class itself. You know, that is the price of bureaucratism and a prolonged hiatus in socialist, you know, sort of in socialist consciousness. And that it's not that the Soviet Union particularly changed. It obviously had changed, but not massively. But its relationship with the working class had been molecularly undermined, I suppose you could say. You know, the consciousness of the working class went down. You know, and that's true, I think, also defeat of the working class in the West did not help. You know, neoliberalism. It's a different historical period. As regards China, I'm not absolutely... You know, I'm not necessarily dogmatically bound to the point of view that there was a counter-revolution in China. I think the decisive point was in 1992. But you have a very different situation. This is not the same sort of regime as Mao. You know, Mao led although it was a Stalinist regime that ultimately went into conflict with the Soviet Union and even allied with U.S. imperialism in the 80s. Nevertheless, it's still in structurally and the way it worked, it was a Stalinist regime. But after Deng became dominant, and after, you know, particularly in the 80s, and then in the 90s, there was a series of accelerations of marketization. I think in the 80s, it more or less stayed within the framework of an NEP type thing. Of a workers' state where the bureaucracy ruled, and there was a widespread, you know, marketization and the growth of a certain element of sort of like, you know, proto-capitalism in the 80s. In the 90s, it took off massively, and you do see the growth of this billionaire entrepreneur class interpenetrating with the state bureaucracy. And, you know, I mean... In terms of our tendency, we always thought Deng Southern Tour, when he went on a massive counter-offensive against those in the bureaucracy who wanted to retreat from marketization and basically defeated them, was the decisive point where a counter-revolution from above had taken place, and those who wanted to go back to some sort of planning were defeated. You know, that was around 1992, not long after the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually, when the people in Russia who wanted to who wanted to resist Gorbachev's program of rapid marketization, they launched a coup in August 1991, which lasted 3 days and then collapsed. You know, it was a bit different in China. You know, it was. Particularly Yeltsin had left the Communist Party, was mobilizing outside the Communist Party. He's still part of the bureaucracy. His origin was in the bureaucracy. He was the head of the Moscow Communist Party, but he left the Communist Party and mobilized a new movement to actually take power and introduce rapid transformation to capitalism. That's not what happened in China. It came from within the regime. The regime stayed intact. You know, So I think, I mean, there are differences in our tendency about exactly what that means, you know, whether it was a complete overthrow, whether it created a new form of whether the bourgeoisie is really dominant and the state forms that exist are residual, or whether that didn't go as far as that. I noticed that there has been a bit of debate about that in our tendency. I mean, we're not going to hide that, you know. But it's very clear that in Russia, there was a counter-revolution, yet it was rolled back, at least partly. And now the bourgeoisie hates Russia. Wide sections of the bourgeoisie hate Russia. And, you know, even Trump is still, although Trump professes to have a more reasonable attitude to Russia, it's more of a tactical thing because they seem to sort of realise that China is the main enemy, you know, because China is more economically powerful and the main, you know, the main force that's likely to push the US out of its hegemonic position. But as to whether China is imperialist, I think it's mainly China that the Belt and Road project. I don't think the Belt and Road project seems to me to be an infrastructure project. It's not, you know, China does not send its military forces around the world to enforce you know, the extraction of raw materials, etc., etc. It doesn't behave like a classic imperialist power. In fact, it does seem to be actually trying to develop its allies or its putative allies in the global south and actually provide them with things that the imperialists do not do and never have done. You know, trying to develop capitalism, whereas what the imperialists did in so many countries, they actually tried to suppress capitalist development so that they could extract stuff for their own benefit. You know, they suppressed capitalist development in India and Africa and a whole lot of places. The Chinese are not trying to do that at all. They're actually encouraging it, which does raise questions about whether they're capitalist or not. But they are actually encouraging the development of other of industry and of capital in other countries, in underdeveloped countries, which is not classic imperialist behaviour, actually. It's very much the opposite. But that's my view anyway. And I see Simon wants to speak, so I'll let him come in. Yeah. Cheers. And Weibo wants to speak after Simon.
Okay, so it was stated that Trotsky said that it was a contradictory system, and that history would eventually decide, you know, concretely what it amounted to. Now that to me sounds kind of like Hillel Tikhon. So I was wondering what you think of Tikhon's views and why ultimately I think the consensus is within your group that you reject those kinds of conclusions that he makes. I guess because of a potential reactionary conclusion that the West was kind of more advanced. It has that pit hole in the same way that Chapman's theory did, and a lot of the people that came out with this theory of bureaucratic collectivism kind of ended up siding with Western imperialism. So I guess that's the caution that you might advocate around Tikhon's kind of theories. But you know, to echo John's, you know, admission to being a bit impressionistic, it does sound, what I've heard about the experience of life in these Stalinist states, it sounds more like what Tikhon describes, rather than this kind of optimistic view that there was some kind of preservation of some of the gains of the October Revolution. There was a lack of dynamism in the economy. There was lots of waste. A friend of mine who did work in a Stalinist state in a factory said that the workers were completely alienated. And this, his observation of this was what encouraged him to go back to the original Marxist classics about alienation. He reinvestigated it from an observation with inside this so-called workers' state. People say that in Czechoslovakia, the best way of describing it is that life was like a, every day was like a Sunday in the West. in terms of its negative aspects. So alienated labor, lots of waste. However, to counter those kinds of arguments, what would you say were the day-to-day experiences that were positive in a Stalinist state, which had their foundation upon those preserved gains of the October Revolution? Because you talked about the working class of, you know, hadn't really experienced what life was like under capitalism, or the healthier period of the worker state. When it collapsed, it was 50 years later. So of course they've been seduced by the West. I remember a friend of mine telling me that his father went on a business trip to the West and came back with fizzy jelly cola bottles. And he said at that very moment when he put a fizzy jelly cola bottle in his mouth, to him it was an absolute concrete reality that Western capitalism was superior to the Stalinist state. So yes, there were some amazingly ridiculous kind of illusions and reductionistic kinds of things. But then the social contract that the Stalinists offered people there was just a crap version of consumerism, ultimately. So day-to-day life was a crap version of consumerism, alienated labor, lack of freedoms, and a wasteful kind of economy, as Tikhon describes it, which I think is quite convincing. He did live in the Soviet Union for a long time. How would you counter it in terms of the day-to-day experience? What were the benefits that the workers would have experienced day-to-day? They may have been unappreciative of them, but can we concretize that a little bit?
Yes, certainly. Who else wants to speak? Say, Revo wants to speak. Yeah. You're muted, Weber.
On the last point made by Jonathan, well, some of the benefits, I was in Cuba 1989. Quite the experience, but that's a whole other story. Life, you know, because it had a planned economy, though it wasn't, you know, under democratic control of the working class, it still, life was very affordable in the Soviet Union. Basically, free education, higher education, housing, transportation, food. It wasn't the best quality, and there were maybe long waiting lists, but everybody could eventually afford to own a car, to have some housing units, be able to put your kids to school, all on the cost of the worker state. But then another point is, on China is, and it's kind of economic domination of internationally expanding BRICS, of course, goes against their mantra of peaceful coexistence with the imperialists. I mean, they're going to get irked, right? The U.S. and Europe are getting irked by this expanding economic bloc that's not dominated by Western banks. And talking about domination of Western banks, is not the key element of the definition of imperialism, that it's disguised with the dictatorship of finance capital. If that is not the case, then neither China nor Russia, we could neither characterize China nor Russia as imperialist powers. Also, another thing that popped up is that, of course, the other side of the coin is of peaceful coexistence with the imperialists is the building of socialism in one country. Well, the whole BRICS seems to go counter to that. They're not focusing merely on building socialism, whatever that means in China nowadays, in one country. And why would that be? I think this might be a reflection of the fact that it's still a worker state. And every year, millions of students finish their studies and need to find jobs and need to find positions within the economy. And the Chinese economy must be able to provide such opportunities for a decent living standard for the Chinese workers If not, perhaps there's going to be an outbreak of social unrest. I mean, there are thousands of cases every year, if not tens of thousands in China, where local bureaucracies are being contested by the local populations because they're dissatisfied with whatever element over which they have no democratic control. So, that's what I wanted to interject.
Marie?
I think this is very important. Would you mute you? I think.
I know what we'll do. Maybe I'll just mute him.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to. Very interesting points have been made. When I think it was Wibo who said, when was that crushing of the working class in Russia? When did it happen? And then all the points that comrades have made about China, I think it's worth going back on later on. I would like to return to the text a little bit. I have seen a part which I would like to raise again. The question of when Trotsky says the victorious revolution, I'm talking about Russia, is fortunately not a program and a banner, not just political institution, but also a system of social relations. And I think this is interesting in the context of what Simon was saying, you know, how do you see in practice, in the social relation, how do you see something socialist there? Then Trotsky says, the victorious revolution has a great power of resistance, coinciding with the established property relations, with the living force of the proletariat, the consciousness of its best elements, which is the Bolsheviks, which applies to today as well, and the impasse of world capitalism. I think these things are pregnant, really, and applicable to today, because how is it that the bureaucracy of the Soviet Union, how is it that it did not lead to a return to capitalism, considering all the backwardness, which I think Simon mentioned, the aspects which are not socialist, considering how much of this and of the length of time when the Soviet Union existed with a tremendous backwardness of leadership, of bureaucratic leadership, which should have logically have led not just to the emasculation of the socialist relation, but to their overthrow, which includes the property relations. That this did not happen. I see in the text, Trotsky says, the bureaucracy has not yet, that is in 1936, has not yet created social support for its dominion in the form of special types of property. It is compelled to defend state property as the source of its power and its income. In this aspect of its activity, it still remains a weapon of proletarian dictatorship. Now, I might be perhaps a bit crude about this, but it seems to me that this is still valid, that with the regeneration, the partial return, the renationalization in with Putin, this wouldn't have happened had there been a degeneration to the point of the returning to capitalism. This could not have been returned. It would have been beyond it. But it had, actually there was the basis for Putin to do that. And he became surrounded by a layer, I think you said, of billionaire entrepreneurs a billionaire entrepreneur class, which were probably the old bureaucrats. But I would like to comment on these entrepreneurs, because we have left now the time in history when capitalism is, apart from technology, is an entrepreneur in the development of its system. Yeah, there might be entrepreneurs in this and that, but as a ruling class in the world, it's not enterprising anymore. It's just speculating. And the period we are talking about, the 90s, is when really speculation is the functioning of capitalism. And so that layer, it's not a class, that layer around of old bureaucrats, ex-bureaucrats around Putin, they were unable to develop themselves as entrepreneurs who are going to use the capital they have stolen from the state that they have denationalized, to use this money to actually build a capitalist class. They didn't do that, and they became corrupt, and in fact they were not a class, but just a mafia. And this is an expression, it seems to me, nowadays, of what Trotsky called the impasse of world capitalism. This is it. We are at the point where capitalism is actually leading absolutely nowhere. It is absolutely required for any state to take control to a degree of what the capitalists are doing in order to actually respond to the minimum of social needs. And this they fail to do, since they don't, in this country, they don't build houses, which is the obvious place where to put the money. And so, I would like to conclude with this, that I do not believe that there was a proper counter-revolution. There was a partial one, and in Russia and in the Soviet Union. And the disaster has been on a world scale, where in fact the countries which the Soviet Union used to support were left to their own devices, and that left them open to the devastation of capitalism. So it was a big counter-revolution on a world scale, but it was partial in the Soviet Union. And I think China never really had a Marxist Bolshevik leadership. It had a small working class and a very, very large peasantry, and its leadership developed a very sui generis, if I can say, sort of worker state, which was never really an example to the world masses, whereas the Soviet example was and is an example. And so it seems to me that the fact that in China they are capable of absorbing the people that come out of the colleges or the universities every year and create an economy which is in constant, it's not an economic expansion, it's an expansion of creativity, and that at the same time, without screwing the other countries of the world, this is not capitalism. I don't know what we call it, but it's not the functioning of having to destroy somebody in order for you to have what you need. This is humanity is beginning to go over the we have to kill in order to live. We are just entering that phase. And it's capitalism that just kills, because for its regime to continue, it needs to impose itself, and to impose itself, it feels it has to remove the populations. But we should go back to this later. Yeah.
I just want to come in again in response possibly to Simon, and I'll start off with what Simon said about Tikhtin anyway, but I think Tikhtin pointed to some interesting facts about the way and the consciousness of the working class in the Soviet Union, the alienation, I think the point you made about alienation is very true, you know. But I think he was overall wrong. I mean, his position was that there's no mode of production in the USSR. And I think that is wrong. I think that there was, it's a very unclear situation, and it's not really made very clear by Trotsky, actually, if you read The Revolution Betrayed, because his view that the removal of the Stalinist regime would simply lead to the collapse of what socialist production there was in the Soviet Union has proved not to be true, not in the direct sense anyway, you know. And I think that illustrates that there was the beginnings of a higher mode of production in Russia. And I think some of Trotsky's formulations do underestimate that a little bit. And we can now see, you could say in hindsight, we can now see in such things as DeepSeek and Arezhnik, so there are two examples of one military, one of non-military technology that have come out of these former workers' states that are in advance, considerably in advance, of the most advanced capitalism of today, of the most advanced imperialist capitalism today. How could that happen if these societies were simply backward, you know, and that they were stagnant? I'm not denying there was stagnation in the USSR, particularly, I mean, it became notorious. They used to refer to Brezhnev's era as the era of stagnation, you know. It was real, but it wasn't everything. I think the alienation was there, the destruction of the consciousness of the working class. And, you know, I think Weibo was correct. He pointed to the various benefits that workers got from the Soviet Union, the lack of unemployment, the fact that they could get housing, the fact that they could, they could maintain a stable standard of living for most of the time, and they weren't subject to the vicissitudes of market, of, you know, free market capitalism and of losing everything, you know, in what happened in the period of Yeltsin, where there was the neoliberal shock. You saw a massive number of deaths at the hands of capitalism. Fortunately, it was rolled back, at least considerably rolled back, possibly not entirely, but it was rolled back, and that period is now over.
What
they say, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, you know. Well, that was what happened in Russia, and that's why there is this wave of nostalgia for there is a considerable element of the Russian population that would love to go back to the Soviet Union as they remember it, you know, because it was better, you know. And that partly finds expression in popular support for Putin, who manages to straddle that sort of sentiment. He's not overtly pro-communist, but he's not anti-communist either. And he sort of balances an element of both. You know, that is part of Putin's popular appeal, and he does have popular appeal. There was no inflation, you know. I think there's, you know, it's a very contradictory society. But, I mean, Tikhon said there was no mode of production, you know. That was wrong. There was something that actually, we can now see, because, if it was just a basket case, if it was a wreck, if it had no productive progressive element to it, how could China be in advance now of the West in computer technology? How can Russia be in advance of the West in things like hypersonic missiles? I know they're means of destruction, but they're actually means of defense as well. You know, they're not just blindly destructive, but they are a deterrent to the West. I mean, we all know that there were people in the West who wanted a nuclear first strike against, you know, even in the days of Ronald Reagan. You know, this sort of thing is a deterrent. I mean, you know, to the Biden equivalent, you know, it's deterred this stuff very effectively. And it couldn't happen if Russia and China were just crippled by backwardness for so many decades. is precisely the fact that there was elements of a higher mode of production imprisoned within the deformations of that, those workers' states. And you have to understand that, there are different elements in them that made these advances possible. You know, there are elements of Russia and China of an advance of the United States. How is that possible if it was so backward? So that's why I think Tikhtin was wrong. You know, regarding what Marie said about the non-counter-revolution in Russia or the not being a complete counter-revolution, I think that's a matter of that could be a matter of interpretation. I mean, my view is that there was a counter-revolution, but it was stymied by the deformations that came from the more advanced mode of production that had already partly grown up in Russia. You know, I mean, how you interpret that is another question, you know. But I think that's true in China as well. I think that both of these questions are quite complex and there's a lot of nuances and possible interpretations of them, you know. So, you know, there's plenty of room for debate on this. And we haven't said the last word on it theoretically because I think there's more things to unravel and more things to actually elaborate. And sort of, I mean, there's a lot of discussion among our Latin American comrades who are very, very, sometimes it's difficult to follow the debates, you know, because they're in Portuguese or Spanish and whatever, and they don't always translate it well, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think we've, you know, I think the last word has not been spoken on this, but it's, there is room for interpretation anyway. And I will put my hand down and I'll call in John. John, you're muted.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I found that that was an interesting discussion. And we come back to the point of, well, you know, why was capitalism triumphant? Because it was clearly triumphant after 89-92, and it's still hegemonic in many ways over the thing, and that raises a whole load of questions about why did it collapse, and what does that tell us about capitalism, that it was able to you know, see off the Soviet Union and what happened, and not only that, you know, it was able to outrun it in a way by eventually, you know, I mean, you know, that was probably one of the worst moments to be a socialist, is when you saw people dancing on the Berlin Wall, and you know, and again, there were some Marxists who thought that was good, but you know, like my heart sank at that point, and still does when I see images of it. But you know, how were they able to do that? It's, you know, what does that tell us about capitalism?
Anybody else want to speak? Susan.
Yeah, you know, I could do. I've written a couple of notes in my thing. Going back to why are Russia and China winning, Russia in the military field and China in the financial, you know, production field. And I think we're forgetting that Russia and China have had to develop means of defense. Yeah, they know who their aggressor is. They know who their enemy is. Their enemy is the US, which has always said, you know, they are the enemy. They will be wiped out. They know they are defending against, you know, up against what's coming. And as defense, they have to be prepared. But more importantly, they understand America in a way that America does not understand Russia or China. Yeah, you know, it's noticeable. We talk about, oh, well, America's won. America's not winning. Africa loathes it. South America loathes it. That they don't really have much time for us. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm just finishing this sentence. But the thing is, you know, they're victims of their own success. They've sold the Hollywood dream. But you've only got to look at the tent cities in America. Why would most people want to live in America? You know, they sell the dream of being a millionaire. They don't look at what it's like being a person on a pension in this country, not able, you know, choosing between heating and eating. The Western dream that we've, you know, that Thatcherism sold is not there. And I don't think that going forward, I look at it in another 10, 20 years maybe, I don't think Russia and China are going to sit there going, oh, I wish I was an American anymore. I had a student I was teaching in the 20s. He just begged that he would be born an American, that that was his own thing, that he couldn't abide the thought that he was British and that, you know, we were just second-class citizens now. But I'm looking at it and going, in a few years' time, Russia and China are not going to want to be part of the Western dream. So how has capitalism won? No? You know, we are the ones supporting genocide. We are the ones who are, we've had a rude awakening, which for a lot of people who look back on the British Empire and say, oh, well, it wasn't so bad. No, we're not. We're looking at the genocide in Gaza and going, actually, that's what we did to gain the empire, to gain Africa, to spread civilization as we saw it. And it wasn't. No, it was just death and destruction and lies and cheating and above all inequality. You know, even the NHS doesn't function without all of the immigrants that our own racism mistreats and still can't get over. So, you know, I mean, it was Russia that won the space race. Without the bloody man on the moon, Russia would have won that hands down. Because why? Because it was concentrating on what was fit for purpose. Anyway, sorry, John.
You say, has capitalism won? Well, look at this meeting. Look at the average age of the people on this meeting, right?
Yep.
Where are the youngsters opposing capitalism if capitalism has lost? It hasn't lost. It's, you know, it's been pretty effective at winning the argument. That's the problem. And the problem is not, you know, and you just have to look around you where are the youth? Where's the new movement? Okay, there are signs at the moment that something is developing, that it's more hopeful than it's been for a while for us on the left. But the thing is, you know, you just have to look around you to answer the question of whether capitalism has won. Yes, it is winning the argument.
No, I don't think so. You see, because I think we're looking at it from the wrong end. I look at people, look at TikTok, look at the Chinese people who are sitting there living their lives and really living the dream and with their self-respect for themselves. I look at so many people and, yeah, we're just beaten down and we're aging. So, yeah, there are young people. I can look at Traore in Burkina Faso and think, you know, that's a country which is going places. And that's how their socialism is going to work. But not here. We're just stuck with Charles and William and God knows what for the rest of the stupid monarchy. Sorry, Paul.
Yeah, Paul and Weber.
I was just going to make a late point, but I just put in the chat, the American comedian, George Carlin, he once said it'd be American dream that you had to be asleep to believe it. The average person is not part of that American dream. My low point was a reference to what Jonathan was making about the average age group. And I thought, well, I get asked, Ian, as I'm 43, I'm probably the youngest here, could I form a youth group? But on a more serious note, what used to be socialist appeal, I think is now the Revolutionary Communist Party, they do have a youth group for people around 13 to 27, I think it is. So yeah, there are groups out there that do have a conscious youth group. So perhaps Jonathan didn't realise that, but they are out there. Thanks.
Bebo wants to say something. You had your hand up.
Yes, well, just briefly, I thought I was going to say that. Yeah, the implosion of the Soviet Union as a worker state, degenerated worker state, was, of course, catastrophic. But it was not only an economic, political, an economic social counter-revolution, but also kind of an ideological victory for capitalism. Because, of course, you know, for decades on end, the existence of the Soviet Union was always attacked as if whatever the economic system is, it all leads back to the Gulag camps. That is what socialism, socialism was then always associated with Stalinist practices of repression, right? And in that sense, they scored an ideological victory. And that's why there is a lot less young people out in the streets, because there is no alternative to capitalism. This is what it is, and deal with it. The alternative that once existed, or at least was available in the public domain, you know, Mayday in the Soviet Union and its foreign policies and so forth, and a bit of a progressive element to it, is gone. But to me, when I talk to workers or students or neighbors, socialism in brief, to the way I explain it, and you don't have to be a Marxist to agree to that, is that socialism basically means a planned economy under the democratic control of workers' councils, of the laboring masses. And nobody in this whole neighborhood would disagree with me. If I would say the alternative to the system that we have now, and in Holland there's a lack of almost a million affordable housing, there was a news item that in a couple of years there might not be enough quality drinking water for the population. I mean, so if I say, well, what's the alternative to this system, which is clearly dominated by multinationals and the banks? They got their girls and boys in government positions. What is the alternative that favors the majority population, not only the majority population, but the wealth-producing population, the working class, is to take control of the economy, of businesses, and bring them under democratic control of the working class via its own government. We need to bring about workers' governments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like I said, you don't even have to be a Marxist to kind of, yeah, agree that that makes sense.
But if you want to get back to that, you have to. The thing we're not really thinking about is we do not control the money. We don't control the financial world. And that is what undermines the workers at the end of the day.
No, we don't control the businesses. We do the work.
We do the work. But the thing is, I can't buy, you know, I can remember back in the 70s, like, we couldn't buy a house because the bank said no. Why? Well, because I was earning more than my would-be husband. And I'm, you know, and the bank just said no, you know, you don't. It wasn't that we weren't earning enough to pay the mortgage. It was that they wouldn't let us because of their stupid rules. And their stupid rules are down to, you know, prejudice and, for want of a better word, class snobbery. Yeah, they have it's a capitalist system that they do not allow the workers to participate in. They feel threatened by it. That's part of the bureaucracy.
Just a couple of things. I mean, in regard to the question of what was I going to say? I've just lost my thread now. First of all, youth. Okay. That's what I was talking about. I was thinking what I'm going to say. It's about youth. I mean, I think there is a lot of youth around, actually, including in imperialist countries like this. But it's at quite a low level. Look, go on any of the Palestine solidarity demonstrations. There have been mass demonstrations with huge numbers of young people on them. Not all of them are Arabs and Muslims and you know, there's obviously a lot of people, young people who are, you know, of the more mainstream sort of background in Britain, as well, traditional background, etc., as well as people from immigrant backgrounds of various descriptions, people with young Muslim people, young non-Muslim people. You know, I think the growth of groups like Socialist Appeal, or what is now called the Revolutionary Communist Party, are indicative of that. They have grown up. They're quite dynamic, and I think they are involved in a political shortcut. And they are people we need to polemicise against, because I mean, they're. I mean, you can talk about the Socialist Party, the Socialist Workers Party, and now the RCP. They are left reformists who dress themselves in revolutionary garb in various ways, you know, and they have a very long history of that. But nevertheless, I mean, the fact that they can grow and Ted Grant's fairly sober social democratic group is now calling itself the Revolutionary Communist Party is a sign that things are potentially there, that we could actually grow. You know, probably not as many. I think some of their perspectives are over optimistic and are a bit of a fantasy, but nevertheless, there is the basis to build a sizable or a reasonably sizable organisation of subjective communists. The problem is that really is the ideology, you know, the serious Trotskyist left, the serious Marxists have been somewhat marginalised as part of the big ideological backwash over the last 30 or so years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and things are just beginning to. The growth of things like Socialist Appeal, etc. Why do I keep calling them Socialist Appeal? Because that's what they are. You know, is a symptom that things are changing. You know, but we have to do a lot more. Obviously, we have to. There's a lot more work to be done to build something sizable and more serious that could actually attract a lot of those people. And that's why we have educationals. We have to educate ourselves among anything else to get into these arguments, you know. But yeah, I think, you know, I don't think it's quite as, you know, it might appear that we're just a bunch of old fogies who are meeting up and discussing things. But I mean, a few years ago, this group didn't exist. You know, I mean, we've had so many problems of the serious Trotskyist left that shot itself in the foot so many times, as well as, you know, the opportunities coming and slowly accelerating. We went through a very bad period, and it's led to sectarian problems and all sorts of political problems. I mean, the one serious organisation is the Spartacists. They were a very serious political tendency. Both me and Weibo come from that background to a degree. And that organisation has been through agony, cultism and blowing itself up and then reconstituting itself in a manner that's not particularly that bad now, actually, although they have problems. But there are lots of problems on the serious Trotskyist left that need to be resolved. It's regroupment, really. That's the solution to it. And political debate is very much to be favoured. I'll let Paul come in anyway. I don't want to rub it on too long. Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow Weibo and then follow on from what Susan had said. It's a combination of two. I take what Susan said about the snobbery and the... But and that sort of thing about getting mortgages and that sort of thing. But the thing is, when you're in revolutionary territory, and if we go back to the Cox's test, particularly the last sort of few paragraphs that Marie mentioned earlier, it's quite clear that nothing is set in stone. And this is the complication between the productive forces and what we're talking about here in terms of student points, is the contradiction that comes from the social relations. And the thing is, you're always going to have things going backwards and forwards, and we should not get into that crap believing that this is the final victory, as it were. Because otherwise, if we did that, we might as well all give up. I think these things are constantly evolving. And I think we need to remember that. Thanks. I don't know if that made sense.
Does anybody else want to speak?
I would agree with you all. I think not least because we're looking at the defeat of the US Empire. And not saying it isn't going slowly, but and it isn't, you know, doing a hell of a lot of damage on the way down. But it is not what it was 20 years ago. And I don't think it's going to manage another decade, do you? not in the way it is. After all, it might come back as something different, but I'm looking at Trump trying to manage the decline. I don't see him as, he's not going to make America great again, although he might make America focus on itself instead of trying to police the world, but it's doing a really bad job of policing the world. You know, that's why it's such a chaos.
Yeah.
We better speak. And then Marie.
I would like to continue to that.
Weber, when he's hand up slightly first.
Sorry.
You want to speak, Weber?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Yeah, you made an important point. Of course, you know, there's lots of youth still being activists, going to pro-Palestinian demos, anti-racist demos, I guess police violence, and so forth. I'm just saying that the ideological way to becoming a revolutionary fighting for socialism is just, it has been lengthened somewhat. And a handicap to that is that there is so very few united front actions anymore, where the Trotskyists and all the other Marxists come together in the united front action and, you know, have a larger presence, and also that would stimulate the whole regroupment effort that we're trying to stimulate, right? And I think problematic to that is that a lot of these, long time, decades long cadres of the Trotskyist organizations and the Stalinists and so forth, they are pretty firmly integrated into the trade union bureaucracy. They operate as left lieutenants, actually, of the Social Democrats, right? And the trade union bureaucracy doesn't like it when you start, you know, calling for action on this issue or that issue, because that puts you on the spot. And the top bureaucrats are going to say, hey, man, this guy is a bit of a troublemaker. And we could see that in a socialist fight. Remember when they were being accused of anti-Semitism and were thrown out of the Labour Party, right? And that is what I find so disappointing from the cadres, you know, of long-time cadres of these organizations, the IBT, the BT, you name them. Most of them have, you know, somewhat very experienced cadres, but they're just, I don't know, I don't want to, you know, completely condemn all of them, but they've become quite conservative, actually, when you think about it, right? And mid-level trade union positions do have certain benefits. I used to When I was living in for example, when I was living in Canada, I went to college for social work, and I did my apprenticeship not in a nursing home but with the local trade union. So I would assist this trade union organizer, and what would we do at noon? We would go to a nice Italian restaurant and have a fine meal,
right,
which was paid by the union, by the trade union membership. I mean, we could just eat a $30 meal. That you didn't have to pay out of your own pocket. And there's all kinds of such small benefits to trade unionists. I don't know, I'm just guessing a little bit, but this has been kind of germinating in my mind because I just can't understand this kind of behavior, which is so unexpected. If we compare it to a couple of decades ago, in the 70s or the 80s, when there was a lot of workers' militancy, wildcat strikes, and all the rest of it, but that has lessened quite a bit. For example, today, a lot of Trotskyist organizations, they stand on the historical precedence of, in certain situations, for example, a genocide, to call for political strike actions by the trade union movement. IBT, IG, SL, us, we would all support that, I assume. Now, that would raise the political consciousness of these port workers and other sections of the working class as well, right? Political strike action. We're gonna boycott weapon transports to Israel and all kinds of other economic freight, whatever. We're not gonna handle it. We're not gonna load it. We're not gonna unload it. We're gonna let it sit in the port. Why can't the Trotskyists and these other Marxist organizations come together in some kind of united front on this? That would benefit everybody. By the way, I need to go pretty soon, in about a half hour.
Well, I think you've got two more speakers, and then we'll wind this up, I think, yeah?
Okay.
Marie wanted to speak, and then I'll let Diana speak first, because she's not spoken yet. And then we'll let Marie speak, yeah? Hello, Diana.
There was some comments about waste in the USSR, and the waste of capitalism and the environmental destruction of capitalism isn't mentioned enough. And there's a younger generation. Well, it should be amongst everybody, but I think it affects the younger generation more. The environmental destruction, the destruction of the ecosystem, is very much on their minds. Mm. But what got me interested in Marx recently, I mean, I've never dismissed Marx, but I never took that much notice either, was discovering that Marx and Engels were actually very much environmentalists, and if that, and I think Marx actually changed over his lifetime. He sort of learned more about science and the environment and stuff as time went on. But if younger people understood that and understood the relationship between Marxism and supporting ecosystems, and how the opposite, capitalism, is destroying the ecosystems, and it's already hitting us, but younger generations are going to live through that big time. If they understood that, they would be more interested in Marxism and overthrowing capitalism. And the comments about the waste in the USSR, well, I don't know, obviously, I don't know how bad it was, but I imagine it could be, it would have been, it would come about by poor management and incompetence. But it cannot compete with the waste we have under capitalism. And I left Simon's example of the, was it some kind of yucky cola? And the protection of rubbish like that, that is intentional waste in the capitalist system because it makes profits for people. It's environmentally destructive waste. I mean, that was just one small example. I mean, it's, you know, we have to keep upgrading all our technology and all the then there's all the junk substitute for food that's foisted on people. That makes profits and it's wasteful. It's all the weapons systems are wasteful. They destroy the environment and they're wasteful. Brain's a bit dead, otherwise I could think of millions more examples of fast fashion, people wanting to show how much money they're spending because it makes them look poncier. I'm proud of my 28-year-old car with the moss and that lichen on it. I listen to Gardener's Question Time a lot, watch gardening programs. There's people into poncy lawns making their gardens look neat, and putting down astroturf and concrete over their gardens. That's environmentally destructive, and it's waste producing that toxic plastic. The list is absolutely endless. I think maybe I've gone on too long to make a point that I wanted to, and I've forgotten. Anyway, I've probably said enough.
Okay, Marie, and should we finish after that, yeah?
Okay, thank you. I would like to go back to the text, yeah? About state capitalism. So why is the state constantly trying to do something in society and production? Why is it intervening? Why are there regulations? So he says the very necessity of such measures is one of the signs that the productive forces have outgrown capitalism and are bringing it to a partial self-negation in practice. And I think this is what, in fact, we are discussing, that even capitalism is not capable of maintaining its the purity of its endeavor, which is freedom, liberty, democracy, and no interference and independence from everything. These are just abstract ideas, which in practice capitalism does not practice, and that it doesn't even practice towards itself. And so I think we have to take heart from this, that there is no future for the system. The system has no future. And I wanted to continue just briefly what Susan had started when she said she doesn't see 10 years of the continuation of things as they are. I think that's what she said. Yes, I agree with this, and I think the form it's going to take, and which it is taking, is war preparations, which is something that we don't discuss, but it is there in front of our face, as bigger than any elephant. They are preparing for war, and now Lithuania is talking of 5% and 6% of GDP. If you look at what NATO says, it's pure and simple war preparations. And it's in our face. And they do say, the Americans, that they have the right to the first strike. One cannot just sail past and just look at everything else without looking at this. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, comrades, should we wind this up now? I think we've had a very good discussion, actually. I think it's getting on towards, well, it's getting close to 6 o'clock, and I think this meeting has gone on probably quite a long, you know, quite a long discussion, quite a fruitful discussion. Does anyone want to, I'm going to stop the recording And then we'll go on to any other business if anybody wants to raise anything else, yes? If that's okay with comrades. Is that okay? Weaver, do you want to say something?
Diana, she makes a good point, of course. There's advanced potential ecological collapse happening and so forth, but, you know, and I share them very much. I share them very much, you know, plastic, all the rest of it. But I just kind of feel like we should have faith in technology. You know, if the scientific world would put itself to task and come up with some solutions to the CO2 pollution that's accumulating, causing, you know, global warming. I mean, they can send rockets to Mars, though we have to wait and see. But anyway, you know, I mean, if we put their minds to it and we provide them with the resources and the tools and the means to do that, then perhaps any such problems could still be solved. For example, I mean, there's droughts happening all across the planet, certain regions, but there is already the technology, but it requires a lot of energy to desalinate seawater. You can build a plant on the coast of Africa, or, you know, all along the coast of Africa, and take that salty seawater and transform it into non-salty water that can be used for agriculture. But it's very expensive, it costs a lot of energy to do, so it's perhaps not cost effective. And those companies, they don't care about the Africans because the Africans don't have the capital for Western products. I mean, who cares about those people? They can't buy your products anyways. They're just, those countries are just useful for the extraction of natural resources, and that's it. Okay.
Sure. Paul, and then Susan.
Okay, Susan first, then
Paul. Yeah.
Okay. If you keep up with what's happening in China, they are doing incredible things to re-green deserts, whole deserts that they are doing, not just with solar, but with everything from, they've done it with rabbits and sheep and goats and all sorts of things to reinsert. Spain is actually using seawater and pioneering low fertilizer, low impact regreening of their land because they're using seawater. The real problem we have in the West is capitalism is based on unnecessary consumerism, and we are addicted to short-term consumerism and a throwaway culture. And I think the only way we're going to save ourselves is to learn to live sustainably. And that is going to require a very different sort of socialism. Okay? But it is out there. What we have to learn to do is to stop being what I call nanny politics and telling other people how to solve their problems and actually show people by example that we're solving it here. You know? And it's not one solution fits all. It's not only one way of doing it. But if you would like to see some of the amazing things that are happening, Weber, I'll happily share. But I'm sure if you look, you'll find them. All right? But they are out there. They are re-greening the deserts, and they are doing things together. Yeah?
I am very aware of that. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I'm very aware of that. I follow that as well, what we're doing in China with the desert and so forth.
You know, I mean...
The prerequisite of your proposal can only be based on the establishment of workers' governments.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not going to happen under capitalism.
No, it's not going to happen under
capitalism first, and then start addressing these major ecological and other problems.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Paul.
Yeah. Sure.
With the last point Marie came back on, I may have misunderstood the point that Susan was trying to make earlier on. I thought she was indicating that the US has already had the final victory, and I'm trying to explain that I don't believe that's the case, and that's why I referred to the text that Kroksky was referring to about how, you know, the contradiction between the socially evolving and the productive. So I'm sorry if I misunderstood what was said earlier. The point about the environmentalism and technologies, I'm reluctant to go down the route of talking about individual consumption, because that bodes more scale, and that does rather let the capitalist off the hook. It's the system that's the problem, not necessarily the actions of individual consumption per se. And I think with technology as a whole, I think we should embrace, I think the real issue is not the technologies, but who have control of technologies. And therefore, that's to do with class, with everything we've been talking about. Technology is not the enemy, it's the people that make the political decisions and the people that control the actual productive forces that is the problem. Technology, in the hands of the working class, actually allows us to use land, produce energy and so on in more efficient ways than humanity could ever have dreamt of in the past. It's about who controls it, ultimately.
Okay, Thomas, can we wind this up? Because it really is getting close. It's almost 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in Webo's zone, I think. Anyway, Thomas, should we think about having a forum in a couple of weeks' time? We'll have a discussion at the brunch meeting on Wednesday as to what the forum should be about, perhaps. But I think we should do that, because we get some very good forums and things. So shall we wind up there until then? And obviously the comrades are actually members. I'll convene the brunch meeting for Wednesday. And we'll all keep in touch anyway, yeah? Okay?
Yep.
And I'll see you, comrades, soon. And I'll stop the recording now.